Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. Today we will explore an open question that I find particularly fascinating. Can life be merely an accident? That is, can life have arisen by random chance through purely natural processes? We will discover that there are many exacting prerequisites for the existence of any imaginable form of life. And we will also discover that their occurrence by random chance is extraordinarily improbable. We'll begin by considering several different aspects of this topic. What does it take to make a universe that's viable for life? What are the atoms that life requires? How likely is a habitat that can support life, possibly an Earth-like habitat? And what is the role of a genetic code, such as our own DNA? During our discussion today, you'll probably want to check out some of the images that are posted on the website. So while you leave open the window that's providing this audio track, open a second window and go to guidetothecosmos.com. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Click on the microphone icon on the home page, and that will bring up a menu of radio shows. Click on today's show, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? First, let's discuss what a universe has to be like in order to be able to sustain any form of life at all. Einstein once said, "What really interests me is whether God had any choices when he created the universe." And I think what he meant by that was, do the laws of physics and math constrain the universe to be pretty much as it is, as we see it, or could the universe have been radically different and still satisfied those laws? 50 years after Einstein's death, we now know a great deal more about our universe than he did, and we now know that there are 20 parameters that are not fixed by the laws of physics and math. 20 parameters, they're more or less each like knobs on an oven, setting the temperature or the cooking time. So there are these 20 knobs, and one could adjust the knobs to pretty much any value one liked, and push the enter button, and out would pop a universe, and it would obey all the laws of math and physics. Except that it turns out that unless each of these knobs is set to almost exactly the same value that it has in our universe, it would not be possible for life to exist at all. So let me give you a couple examples. The initial curvature of the universe in some appropriate units could have any value between minus 1 and plus 1. But only if the value is extremely close to zero could life exist. If the curvature was even slightly more than zero, the universe would have very rapidly collapsed, and there would not have been a chance for galaxies and stars and planets and life to exist at all. If the curvature had been even slightly less than zero, then the universe would have expanded so rapidly that there would only be perhaps one atom in the observable universe. And again, there would be no chance for galaxies, stars, planets, and life. Imagine that you had a ruler with minus 1 at one end and plus 1 at the other end, and the curvature could be anywhere you want between one end of the ruler and the other. Now imagine this ruler is made of some rubbery material, and let's start stretching it. And we keep stretching it further and further and further until finally we have stretched this ruler across the entire expanse of our observable universe. If we stretch the ruler that far, then the space in the center, near zero, in which life could have existed, would still be thinner than a single atom. That's how extraordinarily special the curvature of our universe had to be for it to exist as we see it today. Let's take antimatter as another example. Matter and antimatter are like the yin and the yang. And by and large, the forces of nature treat matter and antimatter in exactly the same way. Whatever particles of matter can do, particles of antimatter can also do. But when matter and antimatter meet, they completely annihilate each other. They destroy each other and leave no residue whatsoever, just pure energy. In the beginning, when the universe was created, it was exactly half matter and half antimatter. And if it had stayed that way, then eventually all the matter and antimatter would have annihilated each other, and there would have been nothing left to make stars and planets and people out of. So if the amount of antimatter had remained equal to the amount of matter, life could not exist in our universe. And all of the forces of nature obey this perfect symmetry of treating matter and antimatter in exactly the same way, except for one. The weak nuclear force has a very slight difference in the way that it treats matter compared to the way that it treats antimatter. And in fact, studying that was my PhD thesis. It turns out that there is a 1/3 of 1% difference in the way that the weak force treats antimatter compared to matter. And that minute difference, for which there is no explanation in science as to why that should exist, that minute difference allowed slightly more matter to exist by the time the universe was 1 second old than antimatter. So when the universe was 1 second old, every 1 billion anti-electrons were outnumbered by 1,000,000,001 electrons. And when each of those anti-electrons annihilated with a regular electron and the two of them were converted into energy, there remained just the one odd electron. The one odd electron out of 1 billion antimatter particles and 1,000,000,001 regular particles. And if not for this very slight difference, which science cannot explain the origin of, there would be no atoms and there would be no life in the universe today. Now let's talk about what kind of atoms life requires. If you look at image number 1 on the website, you'll see a sketch of an atom. Atoms are very small, but they're also very simple. They just have two parts, an inside and an outside. The inside is called the nucleus, and the outside is a cloud of electrons. In the beginning, when the universe was created, the only types of elements that existed were hydrogen and helium, and just the minutest dash of lithium. There was not a single carbon atom in the entire universe, not a single atom of oxygen, phosphorus, iron, nitrogen, or any of the other elements that are so vital to the existence of life. In fact, if you only had hydrogen and helium and a dash of lithium, you couldn't make a molecule that had more than two atoms. And I don't think there's any way that life could exist if there are no molecules with more than two atoms. So where did all the carbon and oxygen and these other vital elements come from? Well, as we talked earlier when we had Dr. Jerry Clifford on our show, they're made in the center of massive stars. All the carbon and oxygen in the universe were created in the center of massive stars. And this process is called nucleosynthesis. and it's a very delicate phenomenon. Making carbon is particularly challenging because it takes three helium nuclei to come together and fuse to make one carbon nucleus. Well, it turns out that when three helium nuclei do come together, they have too much energy to make a stable carbon nucleus. And under normal circumstances, what we'd expect is that they just fall apart, so there wouldn't be any carbon in the entire universe. But it turns out that something special happens. If you're looking at the website, check out image number 2, which is a drawing of the energy levels of carbon and oxygen. Nuclei, like violin strings, have higher energy states. Just like a violin string has harmonic notes at higher frequencies, atomic nuclei have higher energy states, which are called resonances. And it just so happens that carbon has a resonance whose energy exactly matches the energy that three helium atoms have when they come together. And there's no explanation for why these two energies just happen to match so perfectly, but they do. And only because they do the three helium nuclei stick together long enough to emit their excess energy in the form of a photon of light and then drop down to a stable state of carbon 12. If this resonance didn't have its energy in exactly the right place, there wouldn't be any carbon in the entire universe. Oxygen has a similar resonance, but in this case, when a carbon nucleus and a helium nucleus come together to make oxygen, their energy doesn't quite match the resonant energy of oxygen. It's close, but it doesn't quite match. If it matched better, then all of the carbon in the universe would have been converted into oxygen. Oxygen's nice, but without any carbon, there wouldn't be any life either. If the match between the carbon and helium nucleus and the resonance of oxygen was any worse, then there wouldn't be any oxygen in the universe. And we certainly wouldn't exist. So the amount of mismatch between the resonance state of oxygen and the combination of the carbon and helium nuclei is exactly what it has to be to give us enough oxygen and enough carbon. And again, there is no scientific reason why that oxygen resonance had to be just the right number. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are exploring the question, can life be merely an accident? We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, GuideToTheCosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's GuideToTheCosmos.com.
We're back, and we're talking about the question, can life be merely an accident? Check out image number 3 on our website. This is a composite image called the Blue Marble, created by NASA from a vast number of small images taken from Earth satellites. In another show, we're going to explore what a rare and wonderful habitat the Earth is and the remarkable properties that it has that enables it to support life. For now, I think it's sufficient to say that the probability of finding a planet with the properties that the Earth has is probably no more than 1 in a billion, which means in our galaxy that there may be a few hundred planets with the qualities that Earth has. And if it is a number in that ballpark, then in all probability, the nearest planet would be several thousand light years away. And with the fastest rocket that we've been able to build so far, it would take about 80 million years to get there. Can you imagine how many times in 80 million years you'd hear the kids say, "Are we there yet?" Now let's talk about the role of a genetic code in supporting life. We don't know if DNA like ours is required for any form of life anywhere in the universe, but certainly there has to be some sort of mechanism that directs the various components of life, the atoms, the cells, whatever life is made of, to come together in a complex way to function as a whole organism. And as far as we know, the only way that that happens is with DNA. Every living creature on Earth uses exactly the same DNA to define itself. And in fact, our DNA is more complicated than the entire universe itself. In each cell in our bodies, we have one complete set of DNA. And in each of those cells, there are more atoms in our DNA than there are stars in a typical galaxy. Check out image number 4 on the website for a picture of a small section of DNA. This is only a 12 base pair long section, and so it could as easily be the DNA of a bacteria as the DNA of a human being, an elephant, or a tiger. The structure of DNA is called a double helix, and basically it's like a ladder which has been twisted in the shape of a spiral staircase. The outside rails of the ladder are made of sugars, and the rungs of the ladder are nucleic acid base pairs. DNA spells out the instructions for creating a life form because there are 4 different choices for the DNA base pairs. So each choice can be thought of as corresponding to a letter. And the 4 letters that scientists use are A, C, G, and T. So it's a 4-letter alphabet, and the sequence of letters spells out how to build all the proteins and assemble those proteins in a way that supports the entire organism. The simplest microbe has about 4,000 of these base pairs that defines its existence, whereas human DNA has 3.2 billion base pairs. If you were to write out human DNA in its 4-letter code, the 3.2 billion base pairs would occupy 260 volumes of a book as large as the Encyclopedia Britannica. We said that there are as many atoms in human DNA as there are stars in a galaxy, but the difference is that the structure of human DNA is vastly more complex than the structure of a galaxy. If you were to take 10% of the stars in a galaxy and swap them with another 10%, it might make no difference whatsoever. But if you start moving atoms around in human DNA, pretty soon the organism will cease to exist. Pretty much all those 100,000 atoms have to be where they are. And 99.9% of the DNA in each human being is the same as it is in every other person. Now let's talk about how likely it is that by random chance, all of the prerequisites of life could be satisfied. It's going to turn out that we're going to end up with some extremely improbable numbers, To translate these numbers into something more familiar, let's use a deck of playing cards. A normal deck has 52 cards, and if it's properly shuffled and you draw one card at random, the chances of that card being the Ace of Spades are 1 in 52, as all cards are equally probable. If you had two shuffled decks of cards and you drew one card from each deck, the probability that both of them would be the Ace of Spades is 1 in 52 times 52. If you had three decks of cards, the probability of all three drawn cards being the Ace of Spades is about 1 in 141,000. And if you had six decks of cards, the probability that they'd all be the Ace of Spades is about 1 in 20 billion. So you get the idea. Every time you increase the number of decks and you demand that every card be the Ace of Spades, the probability becomes more and more remote. So let's evaluate the probability of these prerequisites of life in terms of how many decks we would have to draw cards from and how many would have to be the Ace of Spades. We said that a universe had 20 knobs, 20 adjustable parameters that could be pretty much anything you wanted, but that only in a very small range of each parameter could the universe sustain life. The initial curvature of the universe, we said, could be any number between minus 1 and plus 1, but only in the extremely small region next to 0 could life exist. The probability that our universe had that initial curvature is the same as drawing the Ace of Spades 29 times in a row. Now there are 19 more knobs, and we won't go through them all, but overall, my estimate is that the probability of the universe having all of the parameters in a range that could sustain life is the same as drawing the Ace of Spades 40 times in a row. We know that everything that we see around us is made of atoms, and we know that life requires special atoms, not just the atoms that were created in the Big Bang, but atoms that were cooked in the center of stars, producing carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, and the other combinations of heavier atoms that were not created at the beginning of time. The probability that an initial particle survived the annihilation of antimatter, was collected into a star and converted into one of the atoms that can sustain life, and was then spread out into the cosmos by the explosive death of that star, and then recollected by a new star into a new solar system, and ended up on a terrestrial planet, is the same as drawing the Ace of Spades 11 times in a row. We didn't go through today everything that makes the Earth special. We'll talk about that another time. My estimate is that the odds of a planet being able to sustain life to the extent that Earth does is no more than 1 in a billion, which is about as improbable as being able to draw the Ace of Spades 5 times in a row. All of these are very unlikely, but they all pale in comparison to the probability of producing DNA. Each person has 3.2 billion nucleotide base pairs in their DNA. If we were to take your DNA and throw it up in the air and scramble it, and it fell back down to Earth, what's the probability that it would be your DNA again? The answer to that question is that it is as improbable as drawing the Ace of Spades 1 billion times in a row. Okay, let's not be so demanding. What if we're happy with creating any human being out of your scrambled DNA? What are the odds then? As about as improbable as drawing the Ace of Spades 999,999,994 times. So you might as well hold out for what you want. What about something much less ambitious than a human being? What if we were to be satisfied with the simplest possible microbe, a microbe that has only 4,000 nucleotide base pairs? What are the chances of scrambling 4,000 nucleotide base pairs and getting a living microbe? Well, the answer is that it's about the same as drawing the ace of spades 1,000 times in a row. None of those odds are even remotely possible. None of those specific genetic codes could possibly have arisen from scratch by pure accident, because our universe simply isn't big enough or old enough to expect such an extraordinarily unlikely event to have occurred. So how can I be so sure about that? Okay, let's take the most optimistic possible scenario. Let's imagine for a moment that all the carbon atoms in the entire universe were converted into nucleotide base pairs. And just for fun, let's throw in all the other atoms that nucleotide base pairs need and not worry about whether they're available or not. We would have then about 10 raised to the power 75 nucleotide base pairs. Now imagine further that all of these base pairs are interacting with each other a billion times every second, and that they started interacting from the very beginning of the universe, from the moment of the Big Bang until right now. Altogether, all of those nucleotide base pairs during that entire age of the universe would have resulted in a number of interactions, which is 10 raised to the power 102. And in all of those interactions, we could have only expected one molecule as long as 230 base pairs to have been created at one place in the entire universe, at one instant in the entire history of the universe. 230 base pairs, and only one molecule of that. That's 17 times smaller than the smallest microbe that we know of. And if we wanted 240 base pairs instead, we would have to wait until the universe was 15,000 times older than it is before we could expect just one of those. So hopefully this gives you a feeling of just how extraordinarily unlikely it is that all these base pairs could have come together and created even a single microbe anywhere in the universe. Perhaps there is some natural mechanism that overcomes these vast numbers. Perhaps nucleotide base pairs can assemble in stages and gradually build to a longer and longer molecule until finally they get to the size that they can sustain life. Perhaps. But why is it that we can't see these things? If these things are self-assembling, self-replicating, and stable through some natural mechanism, then why doesn't every bucket of seawater have billions of these things inside of it? None of these things have ever been observed, and none of these things have ever been produced in a laboratory. Some natural mechanism may exist, but why is there no evidence of it? As of today, science has no answer. Certainly, science will continue to advance. It always does. And someday science may have an explanation for how life originated. But the fact is that it does not today. And even if science one day does prove that life could have emerged by an entirely random natural mechanism, even that wouldn't prove that that's the way that life did emerge. So the question is, can life be merely an accident? What do you think? Join us again next week when we will explore the Fermi Gamma Ray Detector, the newest of NASA's spectacular space telescopes operating at the very highest energies of light, with Dr. Leon Rochester. Thank you for tuning in, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.